Hello and welcome to Dairy Pod. I'm John Penry from Dairy Australia. In this episode, our guests discuss some of the considerations when looking to invest in renewable energy installations on farm. From solar to wind turbines and hydro pumps, the discussion offers some questions farmers should ask and what to look for when it comes to securing a quality supplier. For this conversation, Jared Leake, CEO at Australian Alliance for Energy Productivity, is joined by John Cutler, Managing Director for Keyman Energy Solutions, and Mario Como, Senior Project Manager for the Victorian Government Department of Energy, Environment and Climate Action.
Hello and welcome everyone to this second podcast in our on-farm energy series. I'm your host, Jared Leake, the CEO of the Australian Alliance for Energy Productivity, which is a non-for-profit organisation that brings together energy users, advisors and suppliers to help guide improvement in energy performance. My own history is related to dairy is working for Alfa Laval for 20 years, so dairy is very close to my heart, and working with Alfa Laval certainly helped me understand a bit about shed operation and especially energy flows. Over the last few years, I've been with A2EP, and we've been working with Dairy Australia and AgVic to review the results of the Agricultural Energy Investment Plan and other programs that have been focused on on-farm energy. If you missed our first podcast, we covered the basics of understanding your energy costs and how to get started on your energy saving journey. In this podcast, we will explore investing in improving your energy performance, and what to spend your time and money on and how best to do that. So joining me today to discuss that, I have John Cutler from Keyman Electrical Services and Mario Como from the Victorian Government's Department of Jobs, Skills, Industry and Regions. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in the dairy industry?
Oh, Jared, it started off as me being a young electrician and excited about being an electrical contractor, and had the business for about nearly 40 years, I suppose, now, and got to that point where the business was rounded off and established, and I could then choose to do work in the areas that I got excited about. And it started, I was asked to critique a report written about the dairy industry in Victoria from an electrical and infrastructure perspective. And it started off a whole chain of events for me in realising that, one, the magnitude of the dairy industry in Victoria is quite amazing, and it constitutes about 80% of total dairy production in Australia. But it's the single biggest export industry in Victoria, and it's a quiet achiever. But what it did, it pushed all the buttons for me in terms of the areas that I found I enjoyed working, which was basically solar, and the greenie in me was coming out, and I was able to play in the spaces where I enjoyed working. And hot water generation has been something of a bit of an obsession with mine, with me, since I was an apprentice. So the jigsaw pieces all fell together with dairy.
It's all there with dairy.
It's a good industry.
Good, John. We look forward to going through diving into solar and hot water in just a few moments. Before we do that, Mario, I just wonder if you give us a little bit of a background for yourself and where you've come from within the dairy industry.
Yeah, so I've got a mechanical engineering background with electrical as well as environment. So I've got over 25 years experience, and I was asked to do a few projects at the Alamac Smart Farm. We have a herd of 450 cows, so I got involved with a solar array, a battery system, as well as installing new efficient chillers, and also some heat recovery systems. So I've been working in the dairy space in that particular area for about four to five years, and just fascinated about the milk production, what's involved, and there's still a lot of efficiency gains, and some of the projects that we're doing down there are really exciting, and we're also demonstrating those projects to the farmers where they can go on site, touch, feel, and just get an appreciation. And we're experiencing some, you know, challenges ourselves, but we want to, you know, talk about those challenges and actually make farmers more aware of what's involved.
Brilliant. Thanks, Murray. Yeah, absolutely. Ellen Bank, such a great resource for the industry. And, yeah, be very keen to explore some of the lessons learned that you've had there over those upgrades over the last few years. So we'll get into that in due course. Why don't we talk about the largest investment that most dairy farms are making related to energy, and that's solar PV. If you review that AEIP, that solar and things like that certainly made up the number one investment for what was happening there. John, let me start with you. Look, for myself, I've reviewed a lot of different solar installations and said I feel like I'm scratching my head. Some seem too small, some too large, some with the inverter being seen too big. You know, tell me straight up, how do you choose the right solar system?
I think the first challenge for the dairy farmer is he or she have got to say, am I interested in someone selling me solar, or am I after someone that's going to sell me an energy management package? The solar industry is full of people out there in working in volume, and they're working on percentage rebates, and that's what's driving the advice. The fact of the matter is the dairy industry is quite unique, and I've got to qualify this by saying there is no one answer for this, because the policies of distribution businesses in Queensland will well be different to what they are in Victoria. And even within Victoria, the policies for SP AusNet are different to what they are in Powercor. And that would constitute the two DBs that would cover 80, 90% of the whole dairy industry. So I don't believe that there's a simple answer to that. And the problem with your typical dairy farmer is that the load profile is early in the morning and late in the evening. And when that's not when solar is actually creating energy. So my view is to put solar in isolation, it's something of a band-aid, and it might make you feel good, but it's got to be part of a package which talks about energy storage, energy recovery. And when you bolt these three or four components, simple components together, you can create a very, very cost-effective energy management system. And PV is an integral part of that process.
You mentioned energy storage there. What's number one and the easiest with energy storage, and how to think about that and related to your solar PV? What's your recommendation there?
Oh, energy storage, everyone gravitates and thinks batteries. Well, of the three types of storage, that my view and the calculations that I've done is that the battery is the least of the three performers. Heat recovery in conjunction with thermal storage, be it hot or cold, are the two best options. So grabbing as much latent heat you can from your refrigeration plant with heat recovery, to me, is an absolute no-brainer. The second one is topping that up to an operable temperature, which is 80 degrees plus, using solar as your top up is your second best option. And then the next one is to do thermal storage in the form of chilled water is very, very productive and a very cheap way of energy storage. Your battery is your third most, in terms of ROI, is the least performer in terms of energy management or energy storage, for sure.
So it's about getting your hot water or maybe chilled glycol, chilled water, sort of matching that with your solar PV.
Absolutely. And it's a very cheap, cost-effective way of energy storage.
Gotcha. Mario, you've installed quite a large system down there at Ellen Bank. Care to share some learnings and insight on that system down there?
Yeah, so we could have gone a larger system and reduced our carbon emissions and got it to zero. But we decided to go for a slightly less than 100 kilowatt hour, a kilowatt system. And that, of course, was you know, utilising the small-scale renewable certificates to our advantage. But the way we saw it, we're trying to minimise the export. And as John was saying, milking occurs in the morning and in the afternoon outside of those hours. So what we've done, our heat pump, for instance, we've got that running between 12 and 4 p.m. So the 8 kilowatts of energy per hour that that's using is using the solar system. And with the batteries during that solar period, it is charging up until 100 kilowatt hours. So we're trying to, just restrict that export. And at the moment, we're probably exporting, 20 or 30%. And we're getting that slowly down by also trying to get the all-terrain electric vehicles on charge during the lunch periods and so forth. So that's our way of trying to utilise that solar arrays as best as possible.
Yeah, nice one. So some changes in the operation, and you've got some EVs on site as well, then, Mario.
Yeah, there's a fleet of 10. I think we got now 4 electric vehicles. So as they age, we're replacing them.
Yep. Yeah, nice one. And John, let's just flip back to you for the moment and talk about costs and what have you. What sort of range of costs can someone expect to be paying here? If your best estimate right now, and any sort of recommendations on a bit of quick guidance for somebody on whether it's the panels they're selecting or inverters and what have you.
There's so much. Obfuscation and confusion out there in terms of Chinese panels, any good, or are they better than Malaysian panels and all this sort of stuff. And it just makes it very difficult for the end user to get their head around the options. In crude numbers, you'd be suggesting something around $1.20 a watt installed for commercial solar. If you're getting it for less than $1.20, I'd start to think, what am I getting in terms of quality of product? But also, you've got to understand that so many installers, there's a list of 600 that have gone broke in the last 6 to 7 years. And where, if you're the unlucky one to have that legacy, is where's your warranties, where's your backup? But it's easy to say the panel's got a 25-year warranty. If the local distributor or supplier has gone broke in Australia, well, bad luck, because you're not going to go to China to get your warranty or to Malaysia to get your warranty support. So it is incredibly important that you use a company that has got some sort of history, long-term history in this country, and not a newbie off the shelf. You might get it down to 90 cents a watt. Good luck, but in 3 to 5 years' time, when the reality hits, you might find that the $1.20 a watt was a far better value proposition.
Around about $1.20, gotcha. I understand for homes, like if for your own home, it's the advice I've been given is somewhere about 4 times your annual electricity bill, maybe 5 times if you want to go for the higher quality system. For a dairy shed though, you know, they've got an annual electricity bill of about 20,000 per year. What's your guidance there would be if you could use that as a way to say this is roughly where you should be spending on your solar system there.
I'm struggling with that thought process, Jared, to be frank, because it's got to be a much bigger discussion and conversation in terms of what your total spend should be. Like if we're saying what to spend on solar, if you're a traditional typical dairy farmer, I wouldn't be spending a lot of money on solar unless you're prepared to invest in other strategies in conjunction. I think we've got to stop that conversation about solar in isolation. And I look at a factory that operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And because of that 7 days a week stuff that goes on in the factory, you can really develop some load profiles and size of solar to suit, to minimise, as Mario was talking about, minimise that export of a miserable 5 cents. With the dairy farmer, with a traditional load profile, that's very difficult for them to do. So it comes back to the, it could be a heat pump or it could be hot water generation during the daytime and storing that energy. So I'm loath to go down that path, to be frank, because the total package is what you've got to look at, not just the solar in isolation.
And this lends towards just not getting a quote for a solar. You really need someone then who's going to come on site and go through your requirements and really, really understand what that load is during the day and do something much more thorough.
Absolutely. And Mario touched on something which is increasingly coming in, and that's charging of electric vehicles and farm products, stuff like that. And, you know, the all-terrain bikes that are now can be done off-grid. All that stuff complements the solar enormously, but it's pointless trying to charge your battery in your all-terrain vehicle if you're going to be using it during the daytime. So there's multiple ways of getting through these issues, but certainly thermal storage is a great way to do it.
Brilliant. Mario, let's you mentioned batteries before. You've got the chemical ones there, and that sounds like that's resulted in you having quite a low percentage of export from that large system. Can you run us through how that performance and the equipment that you've installed there and what your sort of returns you think you're seeing on that system?
If I take the lithium ion battery, the solar return system alone is we're getting about a six to seven year payback on that. When you add the battery system, you start to pay $850 per kilowatt for the battery. You start to approach that 10 to 13 year mark payback. In terms of the flow battery, we've only got a 10 kilowatt hour flow battery. And the advantage of the flow battery is that we can run it down to zero, and have it isolated. I think the farmers at Almond Bank had the system isolated for 4 months because they were shifting a building, and we just started it up without any issues. The lithium ion battery will be a different story, but on the farm we did spend some extra money on good platforms, so the serviceability and access is really good, and we did spend some extra money on the metering side. So John was touching on 120 per watt. We spent about 160 per watt, and taking into consideration, you know, good platforms. We just want to be able to get up there and maintain the solar array when we have to. And at this stage, we haven't had to do anything and in 2.5 years, bar some, isolations which occurred, you know, during power outages and things like that.
Mm. So you've got something, a pretty decent metering and monitoring system installed on one, Mario?
Yeah, that was a key item to have, and that way we're getting some good data, and that's why I can see overall our electricity bills come down from by $37,000. So I can actually see that physically, and that's a combination of the heat pumps, the solar, and battery system. The battery, I still reckon we can tweak that a bit and get that performing a little bit better. At the moment, we're just we're discharging it in the morning and discharging it fully in the afternoon. But I think we can get that battery going a bit more. We're doing some upgrades on the electrical board at the moment. Yeah.
Interesting. So in terms of utilisation of that battery, you said discharging in the morning and in the afternoon. So you're with that, you should be able to get some pretty good utilisation out of that one.
Yeah, so basically we're just discharging 100 kilowatt hours of the battery. And then at times we can charge it up during off-peak. Mm. But what I'm finding is it's the battery seems to be, if the solar is at its peak, it's looking at the meter and saying, well, don't use the battery. We only need the solar. So the battery just stays stagnant until the solar, you know, the solar energy comes down and the battery kicks in. So, yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. I mentioned before, I've looked at a few solar systems, and we're working with a New South Wales dairy through last year. And La Nina presented quite a problem to work out if your solar system is working as expected. And from the data that we were looking at, we had to wait from between April and November before there was a nice sunny day, fully sunny day, and we could say, yes, it is performing as expected. And during that test, we also found one system that was not performing. You know, is this the norm? Is this how you find out if your solar system is operating well? Because I have heard of quite a few stories where it hasn't been installed, simple mistakes, and it's not performing as correctly. John, how do you go about that? Do you have to wait for a nice sunny day, and what do you do?
Well, you've got to do it over a period of time because you've got no control over the weather whatsoever, and the effect of the La Nina was quite evident, and particularly in terms of rainfall, cloudy days, et cetera, et cetera. So I was really pleased to hear Mario say that they invested heavily in metering, because Ellenbank was about research and coming up with some good advice, and you can't do that if you don't have the level of reporting. The interesting thing is a lot of the products today, and I won't mention brand names because it's not appropriate here, I would assume, but some products provide platforms where you can actually see to the panel what the performance of your system is. And I think they're a good investment. But once again, if you don't read the meter, there's no point in the expenditure, whereas Mario's particular project there, yes, good metering and good reporting is an imperative. And you really have to do it over a 12-month period. What happens in June is going to be entirely different to what happens in July for a number of reasons. It's also, you know, a lot of farmers in June, they're not even milking in some cases, you know, if they're depending on their calving profile or how they're doing that. Other farmers go straight through, but you've got to do it over a 12-month period.
Let's say I've got myself a 40-kilowatt panel array. I've got a 30-kilowatt inverter. How do I check that, John? How am I going to wait for a sunny day and say, yes, I can see the output. I've got to go into my app for the inverter and what have you. Do you just sort of got to trust somebody here? How can you be sure you've got a great
With good systems today, and if you've got the ilk to do it, you can do that. You can do it on your phone, or you can do it. But you know what the ultimate test is? It comes back to the electricity bill. That's what the farmer is interested in, and all the techo people like me that enjoy looking at these numbers and performance levels. What the farmer is interested in is the bottom line entirely. But once again, you can only do that over a 12-month period. Quality equipment will give you really good reporting. Some of the junkier stuff, it's more difficult and clunky. But as I said, you've got to have a want to do it. We discovered a system in a commercial that hadn't worked for 3 years. It just had not worked for 3 years, and then we came in and did our audit, and someone within the organisation has to take ownership of it, and it just becomes another chore in your day, I suppose. But that's with technology today, that's a requirement, isn't it? It's what it's about. If you think you're going to plug it in and forget it, well, you're not.
Mario, what about Ellenbank? How'd you go verifying performance of the system there?
I totally agree with John there. Ownership and making sure the system's operational is a must. So there's two ways of doing it. Like ensure you've got a good cloud-based system set up. And if you don't have, you can still remotely look at it. Now, whether you look at it once a week or once a month, you know, just jot down those numbers, the kilowatt hours, go outside, have a table, just say, what type of day is it? Is it a cloudy day, sunny day? And just put the month or the year. And that'll give you some sort of level of confidence. Now, John can verify this, but my rule of thumb is for every kilowatt of solar array, you get 5 to 6 kilowatt hours. So, for example, if you've got a 5-kilowatt solar array, you should be expecting 25 to 30 kilowatt hours during peak irradiance or peak sunlight brightness. So that's, and over the year, you'll get that peak sunlight, you know, during the summer, so or the brighter days. Now, the other way of measuring it is via irradiance. Now, if you've got the luxury of having an irradiance meter close by, that's fine. But the BOM, the Bureau of Meteorology, will have that information. So, you know, you can look at the sun's brightness and look at your data that you've captured, and then make a call on that. But our 100 kilowatt system, or 99.2 kilowatt system, that achieved 102 kilowatt at its peak, which to me suggests that it's gone over and beyond and it's capable. Now the sun's output, I mean the solar panels are based on 1,000 watts per meter squared, so the sun can give out more than that. But yeah, that's so basically, if you've got a cloud system and you've got the data there, you can visually look at that. And that's a small investment of $10 to $25 for a SIM card and a wireless router. And if you don't do that, at least manually go to the system and look at your kilowatt, what it's producing in kilowatts, and get a feel for what the day's like. And then over the course of 6 months or a year, you'll be able to look at those numbers and see a fluctuation.
So it sounds like worst case scenario, sunny day, you walk over and you add up the values in the inverter and say, right, yep, that's what I paid for. I'm at least getting that.
And I did the same thing as what John said. I basically went to the invoices, looked at 2019 data, so prior to anything being done, looked at 2021-22 data and benchmarked the 22 to 19, and said we're spending $85,000 plus. Now we're spending $50,000 plus. So you can straight away see that there's a cost benefit there. And yeah.
Gotcha. Mario, lots of investments, exciting investments in energy technologies over the last few years at Ellen Bank. Should we say some hits, some misses from what we've heard, but all good learnings to share and make sure that those lessons are done for everybody else. Could you run us through a few of the investments and how they've performed? I know you've done a couple of different wind turbines, hydro and heat pumps and things like that. Maybe you could just give us a quick overview of those so that you're sharing those lessons learned.
Yep. So the heat pump, you're familiar with, Jared, because we've done a bit on that. But it's resulted in a good outcome. We the return investment, and you've got to take into consideration, we did have to replace a system. It was an electrical hot water system, which was aging, 20 years of age. We had to spend that money anyway and have a crane in to move the water tanks and so forth. So we're getting estimated 8-year payback. We're still finalising that data there. But we also eliminated the LPG gas completely. Now, I think from memory, it was costing us $3,000 a year for the LPG gas. So that's another good result. We were initially going to have that as a backup system, and I said, no, just we didn't actually disconnect it. It's still there, but it's not being used at all. So and we did have some challenges whilst we're installing. We made sure we had a backup system in place, and we made sure we were achieving that 80 plus degree temperature, which the heat pump system originally given to us didn't have those controls. But we made sure that we were achieving 83.1 degrees for that system. So it's a good outcome for that one. Mm. With regard to the wind turbines, we installed a horizontal axis wind turbine and the vertical axis wind turbine. The horizontal is the more common type of wind turbine you see out there. Basically, we got some good information, some good data, but we've had some harsh lessons on that one as well. We found that the wind turbine for us was undersized. It wasn't... what we actually specified wasn't provided, and we've proved that by having the data at our hands, and also basically the weight of the rotor. So a 1.5, a 3 kilowatt and a 5 kilowatt, they all weigh differently. So we're just trying to resolve that situation there. We did have fan tips failing and fan blades failing, which is an issue. And then after about 17 months in operation, we out of those 17 months, it probably operated with good data for 8 months. It failed catastrophically. So it's currently offline at the moment. We're looking at of how we approach whether we put another horizontal wind turbine or we go back. We've gone back to the supplier, and we're currently having some issues there. With the vertical wind turbine, currently we've got a very good unit. We are still gathering data for that one. We had to make sure we had compliance with the electrical inspector for that, and we still got one little earthing issue which we're resolving, but we're really positive on that one, and look at getting some good data for that. That one there's got a very good braking setup, and it's got variable pitch control, so we can make some direct comparisons with the vertical. Now, I think that, look, in terms of payback, it's way over 20 years, but as the industry becomes more experienced with these smaller turbines, these 3 to 10 kilowatt turbines, and we get true costs in terms of, running the cable underground and to the location, I think the prices will come down. And the other thing, you definitely have to have a reputable brand. There's brands from China, brands from India, which we found just don't cut the mustard. So that's our experience with wind turbines. Yeah.
And finally, hydro. You took a bit of a look at hydro, pumped hydro as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So pumped hydro, it's purely a demonstration case where we got two tanks, a 40 meter head, and the hydro pump can produce about 1.6 kilowatts. So once again, we're getting some data there. We are using a solar array to pump the water up and then gravity fed down through the pumped hydro system. So the difficulty with putting those onto farms, we have a gravity fed system to from our main dam tank down to several other tanks. So ideally, you could put this hydro kit in between those pipelines. But then, where does the energy go to? It has to go to somewhere close. So that'll be the issue: is running the cabling, setting up an inverter. That's where the cost is. So
gotcha. Return on investment. How the paybacks and things look for that hydro? Is that also maybe it's rather experimental?
It's experimental, and it is excessive at the moment. So it's greater. That's greater than 20 years as well. But once again, we're just trying to get some real data on that as well.
Right. So it sounds like the turbines and the hydro probably not a great investment for the moment. You guys are going to build up data and operational understanding such that if things do change and things start, prices start coming down, then you've got some experience and things to share, no doubt.
Yeah.
What I thought we might round today off with is a little bit about procurement. And Murray, you mentioned a problem that you had with the wind turbines, and let's talk about sort of protections. And John, if you can come clean, you're on the supplier side of things. What is a quality supplier offering in terms of protection for the farmer? We're talking what is it in terms of the warranties? Is it retention of final payments, that sort of thing? What's a good and fair, reasonable one to keep the supplier honest there?
I think it's credibility of the company that's supplying the goods, and a warranty or a 25 year this and a 7 year that and a 10 year that. they're not worth the paper they're written on if the company's gone into insolvency. So therefore, you need to engage with a company that's got some sort of long-term history and can't afford to go broke. It's just a no-brainer for me. If we're talking about a $4,000 or $5,000, $6,000 investment on your home roof, well, what's the worst case scenario? You throw that out and you've lost $4,000 or $5,000. But you're talking about a dairy farmer that might be interested in looking at a $100,000, $200,000 investment long term. Critical that they've got the support over the next 10 years, not for the next 5 minutes. So that established company, the established history within Australia, not overseas, to me is an imperative.
John, any final thoughts on securing a quality supplier and what to look for? What is a quality supplier doing?
This is going to sound a bit bizarre, but when we find a fault and the customer hasn't, and we've identified it and ring the customer up to say 3-5 years after we've done the install that your solar edge system isn't quite performing like it should, we're on our way. What that's done for our business is build that customer relationship and the rapport, and the value add to us is what was a pain has become something that's the word of mouth that's gone on, and the referrals that have come out of us being proactive in terms of warranty, it's proven to be a little godsend. And so much of our business is word of mouth and referrals. And having that SolarEdge backup has been quite outstanding for us.
And the SolarEdge allowing you to monitor what's going on at these installations you've done. Yep.
You've got to be a little bit compulsive, obsessive to be bothered about looking at what your each panel's doing or what your inverter's doing. And the dairy farmer, he's flat out, or she's flat out. They haven't got time to be sitting there looking at what their panels are doing. But if they know that John Cutler's with our power stores and our hot water generation, and I rang the customer up, one, the dairy farmer up one day and said, "What did you do different yesterday?" He said, "What do you mean, John?" I said, "Well, you used twice as much hot water this week as you did last week. What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, we were doing double rinses because we had a little bit of a problem with plate counts and stuff like that." And he loves me to death because I'm telling him before he rings up to say his water wasn't quite at 65 degrees or at 80 degrees where we wanted it to be. So, and we can monitor all that stuff as I sit at my desk.
Nice service. Mario, yeah. I saw you nodding away when John was talking about word of mouth. You've had experience with using that as well and how valuable that is.
Yeah, I had in my notes, look, an installer willing to talk over the phone and advise is a really good start. And the investments are long-term. You're talking 5-10-year investment. So it's even better if they follow up not expecting anything in return except a goodwill and a good reference. And you once you get that good reference, it'll just give you more opportunities of work. And when John touched about, you know, letting the guys know on the farm that there's an issue here, there's an issue there. They're so busy, and then they say, somebody's looking out for us.
Mario, you had some protections in place. It looks like you've got some recourse there. You've gone down the track of maybe not purchasing from someone with a long-term history on that technology, as is the nature of what you're investing in, sort of more R&D type stuff. How'd you go with your protections for when you were purchasing there? Any lessons learned there?
Yeah, so you can use retention, but we don't like using retention. We use bank guarantees in the government, but it's something that's really not really applicable for farmers. But I tend to look if that, the hardware, getting reputable brands, solar panels, the inverters, and I did discover the site called Solar Quotes after the fact, and you can simply go onto www.solarquotes.com.au and you can type in a company, any company, and it will give you feedback on how that company's performed. So, yeah, I just gone at that site and said, well, what's this company look like? And it basically tells you the truth because there's people providing feedback. So that's one way of checking. I know the Victorian government announced 26th of April the new Energy Tech Consumer Code, NETCC. I don't know whether you've seen that, John, but the Clean Energy Council has commented very positively on that. It ensures the retailers are responsible for providing honest, clear and comprehensive documentation to enable them to make the fully informed purchasing decision and to ensure products are fit for purpose. So I think the Clean Energy Council, the government, state governments acknowledge that there are issues there. Just probably look out for that code. And it's a mandate, so obviously they want suppliers to perform to that code.
Excellent. Yeah, well, good to hear those sorts of things in place to really balance out the equation there, making sure the farmer's got plenty of protection and what have you. But, gentlemen, thank you very much for this today. Great to share your insights and wisdom and experience here, and I'm sure this will be of good benefit to many farmers and help guide with their decisions as well. So thank you both for joining me here today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Jared. It's good to chat, Mario.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Jared.
If you would like to find out more about ways to save energy on farm, visit www.dairyaustralia.com.au and search energy. We have also placed a link in the episode notes. We hope that you have enjoyed this DairyPod episode, and if you have suggestions or ideas for future episodes, you can get in touch by emailing dairypod@dairyaustralia.com.au. Thanks very much for listening. And bye for now.